Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The personal data we pour into social media and our online searches is money in the bank for tech giants like Facebook and Google, which use that information to create and market products and services. A proposed bipartisan Senate bill would pull back the curtain on the value of personal data, continuing an effort to regulate an industry bogged down already by data use or misuse scandals. CNN technology reporter Brian Fung has been covering the issue. Welcome back, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
How do tech companies such as Google and Facebook and Amazon, how do they monetize user data?
Well, it depends from company to company based on what business they're engaged in. But, you know, when you talk about companies like Facebook, for example, when you use Facebook, you generate a lot of information about your activities on the platform. And Facebook will take that and bundle it with other users' information and then, you know, offer advertisers the opportunity to market to that segment. So, for example, if you like a page about basketball, for instance, Facebook might go to a sneaker company and say, hey, we can reach all of these basketball lovers with your products advertising. And that's how Facebook makes money from data, as an example.
So they have whole departments just sitting around categorizing bits of information.
Well, a lot of it is also automated.
Right.
And this is really the crux of the issue for, Senators Josh Hawley and Mark Warner, the sponsors of the authors of this legislation. What they are basically saying is that, we don't have a whole lot of transparency into the ways that these companies use and monetize the data. We have a general sense, but when it comes to actually valuing that information, we have very little idea, how much our personal information is worth to these companies' bottom lines.
The Senate bill would require certain tech companies disclose how much personal data is worth. Which companies? How do they delineate which companies are affected by this?
So the legislation proposes to apply to companies that have over 100 million monthly active users. And that distinction essentially is trying to delineate between large platforms like Facebook and Google and smaller companies and startups who may not have as many customers and may not have as big of an influence on the digital marketplace.
And what would the disclosure look like? Would it be a single number? What would it be? Would it be like my DNA score from, Ancestry.com or something?
So that's a really good question, and I don't think that we really have a good idea yet of what this could look like. It could mean everything from a general report that these companies publish periodically, kind of like the way that they publish diversity and transparency reports when it comes to government, records requests, or it could theoretically be something granular and individualized. It could be anything from one to the other. I think it's would be very hard for tech companies to produce a report that went into as great detail as an individualized report, given that a lot of them say that they actually anonymize some of this data so that they can present it to advertisers. What might be most useful for people would be to have a something that's more granular than just, we make, however many hundreds of millions or billions of dollars each year on personal data.
And divide that by how many, how much money?
How many millions of users are
on
the company's platform,
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. There is a Senate bill, a bipartisan measure that would is intended to pull back the curtain on the value of personal data. It's kind of continuing an effort to regulate an industry that, as you know, if you've been following this show, has been bogged down by data use or misuse scandals for really years now. If you have a question or comment, my guest is Brian Fung. He's a CNN technology reporter. He's been covering these issues for a long time. You can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Brian Fung, has anyone ever tried to study this issue independently, surmise, at least estimate what it might be?
Well, You know, there are a lot of analysts out there who sort of try and get a handle on how big the overall data economy is. And really, the main takeaway that we get consistently from these studies is just that the economy for data is enormous and it's growing. But as far as individualized estimates from individual companies go, it's very hard to determine. Aside from perhaps the quarterly earnings estimates and results that these companies publish, it's very hard to determine what portion of that is stems from the use of data specifically.
What about advertisers? How do they know they're getting a fair shake, paying a fair market value for the data that they're buying access to? Or for the users they're buying access to, I should say.
Right. So this is a key part of the proposed legislation. One aspect of it would require that not only for the tech companies to reveal how much they think the data is worth to their businesses, but also to reveal the financial value of any third-party contracts that they may have with other companies that depend on that data. So that could be a could inject greater transparency into how much these companies' relationships are worth with third parties, and the third parties could then see, are they getting a fair deal?
But this also sounds like the usual proprietary information that makes these companies competitive.
That's right, and so I think you would probably find that these companies will strongly resist this legislation, would probably push back on some of these proposals as being too invasive, and that because of the proprietary nature of this information, as you said, it's really critical to their business models and they can't reveal it. So I think there's going to be a delicate dance here where policymakers are going to try and push for more information to be disclosed, and the tech companies will push for less information to be disclosed.
Just from your coverage of this issue, it seems to me that, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that this feels very piecemeal, the way Congress is approaching regulating these, these gigantic tech corporations, tech companies. What about the whole congressional approach to this?
Well, there have been a number of bills introduced, tackling the issue of data, tackling the issue of privacy, tackling the issue of whether or not these companies are too big and powerful. But like you said, it does seem like a pretty scattershot approach, and that just reflects the how challenging it is for lawmakers to wrap their heads around what is exactly happening at these companies. Just also shows how these companies have come to dominate so many areas of our life, that they're involved not only in advertising, but also in media, and also in children's advertising, and providing all of these different services from email to internet service. So it just sort of shows how pervasive some of these tech companies have become in the modern era economy.
Facebook provides an average revenue per user in its quarterly earnings report. In April, the revenue for each user was $6.42, which I guess comes out to about 26 bucks or something like that per year. What's the difference between that number and what the legislation would require? Do we even know that?
Well, the legislation isn't as specific, but in general, the average revenue per user, for one, is just an average. And second, it reflects all of the costs that go into, building a product like Facebook or Google. It reflects all of the different pieces of the business that go into producing, a service for this one user. And so I think what the lawmakers are trying to get at here is something a little bit more tangible, a little bit more specific, trying to put a dollar figure on the actual information that's at stake, not just how much money the companies make in general divided by the number of users on the platform.
Is this for just, I'm still trying to understand what the end game is here when it comes to, figuring out what the monetization is, revealing what third-party deals they have for personal information. Is this a way of checking the industry to make sure they're paying their taxes or something?
Well, there are two aspects to this and that the lawmakers talk about. One is to provide more information to consumers so that they understand that when they go to a service like Google or YouTube or Facebook, that you know, they may be getting those services for free, but they're really paying for it in terms of their privacy. The second aspect of it, too, is you know, that the lawmakers have said by providing more transparency into what may be going on at these companies and determining how they're valuing this personal information, that it may actually help regulators suss out whether these companies are providing a fair shake to third parties and whether or not the tech companies may be acting in perhaps anti-competitive ways. And so, you know, the second aspect of this is kind of an argument about whether or not these companies may be violating antitrust laws.
And so then therein lies, I think, the rub. The antitrust thing is a big issue. And their defense of all of this is what?
Well, their defense is essentially that you know, they operate a free platform in many cases that is widely accessible to everyone. You saw Facebook's global head of communications and global strategy yesterday making a speech in Berlin where he made that argument that you know, they could, while you know, they could charge for Facebook, they believe it's in the best interest of the world to make this a free product that's accessible to everyone, so that everyone can benefit from the connection opportunities that a platform like Facebook provides. And that's really kind of the trade-off here between a paid version and a free version powered by targeted advertising.
Right. So if I paid for it, they probably would have a hard time charging me enough to make up, or we don't know what they would have to charge me to make up for the lost revenue from third-party transactions.
That's right. And, you know, people like Mark Zuckerberg, I believe, have said that they've considered at one point, you know, charging a free product, but charging for the product, but ultimately moved away from that idea as they concluded that the benefits of having everybody on board outweighed the benefits of providing a paid version of their service.
Hmm. Well, Brian Fung, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your insights.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's Brian Fung. He is a CNN technology reporter. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Patient history is a critical part of medicine. What a physician learns during that process could reveal a key fact in a diagnosis. But training physicians to perform this process takes time and coordination. The Ohio State College of Medicine is turning to virtual reality for help. Douglas Danforth researches and studies virtual patients and VR in his lab at the OSU College of Medicine, where he's an associate professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology. Welcome.
Hi, Ann.
What is the traditional training for patient history taking?
So typically, we train our students almost in the very first week. We teach them the questions they should ask, the order they should ask them, what questions are important in which cases. And then they practice maybe with each other, or they practice with what we call standardized patients. Standardized patients are actors from the community that we hire to come in and portray a patient with a particular illness or condition. And so the students will interview a standardized patient, take a history, and people like me will be watching that encounter, and we use that encounter to grade the students, how well they do in terms of taking a history and learning to interview patients.
Is that part of the grading process when they use actors, or is that part of the training process, or both?
Both. Okay. So we use actors for them to practice. They practice with each other, but especially early on, medical students are not great at giving advice. They don't know which questions to ask yet. And so we use standardized patients to help them practice. But one of our primary uses is to assess the students to make sure they have the right skills.
And this is something that goes on throughout medical school?
That's correct. We use it a lot in the first 2 years. I'm the director of the first 2 years of medical school, so we use it a lot then. We use it in the third year as well. And then some of the standardized national exams that students have to take to become certified to become a doctor will use the same thing. They'll use a trained standardized patient to assess the students.
So where does that fall short? Why did you look to virtual reality to replace it?
Well, the supply of standardized patients is limited. It's difficult to schedule that.
Okay.
And they're extremely, it's expensive to run a standardized patient program. You have to have staff, facilities. You have to hire the patients. You have to train them. So there's a lot of infrastructure involved and a lot of expense involved. So we thought if we could make virtual standardized patients, we could give students the opportunity to practice their history-taking skills before they got to a standardized patient or even a real patient.
So how did you approach this task then? What were the challenges?
So the biggest challenge with this is creating the artificial intelligence so that the virtual patient can communicate with a student using natural language. Our students just speak their questions to the virtual patient. A virtual patient is an avatar representation of a human patient. And the students speak their questions, and the virtual patient speaks the answers. And so designing the artificial intelligence and the dialogue management to manage that dialogue and understand the nuances of that interaction is especially difficult. If you think about, talking to Alexa on Amazon Echo, Alexa can give you directions or turn on the lights, but you can't carry on a conversation mm-hmm. with Alexa. So the software that you need for this kind of dialogue is a little bit different, and it's more difficult to do, to keep track of the conversation. What are you talking about when you say something like, when did that happen? So we have to use some pretty sophisticated software to make sure that the patient can answer the questions that the students ask.
What kind of software has been developed? Why is it? Are there other uses for this kind of software that already had been worked? They'd been already been working on it for.
One of the main uses is in what they call chatbot technology.
Okay.
So there's a lot of websites and companies that want to develop chatbots to help you order a widget or learn about, get some customer service. So in areas where the conversation is pretty narrow, you're talking about a specific thing, the software for that is actually pretty good.
Medicine, though, and how you're responding to a physician's questions about your condition is so nuanced in a way, isn't it?
Yes, it is very nuanced. But the way the software that we develop for the virtual patients just has to understand what the student doctor says, because we're teaching the students how to ask the questions. So the number of questions in a doctor-patient interview is finite. We don't worry about trying to answer, how did the Buckeyes do or is it going to rain today?
Mm-hmm.
What is difficult and what is almost infinite is the ways you can ask those questions. So there are a simple question, what brings you in today? That's pretty straightforward, but there are 100 ways to ask that question. And so the software that we use manages all of the different possible variations of that so that the virtual patient understands you're asking what brings you in today, and they provide the answer.
So it's an interesting balance between letting the physician or the physician in training go in there and naturally ask questions in the way that fits their delivery, their personality, that kind of a thing.
Exactly, exactly. And the technology is matured in the last 5 or 10 years to make this all work pretty well. The speech understanding, so the conversion of the speech to text in the last few years is now very, very good. And the machine learning, where how we train the software to understand what the meaning of the question is, that has gotten very good in the past few years.
earlier this month, you tested virtual patients that spoke limited English, and it's obvious that's an important issue. But how does that work? That seems like you're throwing a wrench into the operation.
A little bit, yes. But so the Department of Medicaid wants to make sure that their providers are aware of some of the cultural considerations that their patient population will have. And so we wanted to help train them how to interact or interview a patient who doesn't speak English as their first language. There are different considerations for that. You have to phrase your questions a little bit differently, and you have to determine whether or not your patient is really understanding you. So we created a simulation and a system where we would train the Medicaid providers a little bit about that. So when do you use an interpreter? When can you use a translator? When can you use a family member, not use a family member? And so then we teach them a little bit about it, and then they get to practice with a virtual patient who has limited English proficiency.
And part of then that exercise is understanding and learning when you need to get a translator.
That's correct.
Okay.
And learning some skills.
This isn't to replace translators.
Yes.
Necessarily.
Learning some skills to determine whether or not your patient is really understanding you. Because a lot of times a patient who doesn't speak English very well will nod their head and make you think that they're understanding everything you're saying, but really they don't. And so we also teach them some techniques. For teach back, for example, you explain something to the patient and have them explain it back to you so that you can determine, did they really understand the medication that I want them to take or when their next appointment is.
You know, my experience with elderly parents suggests to me that that's another issue is cognitive, you know, changes and detecting those. And also, and I know there's a rote questions to ask on that case, but also hearing loss.
Yes, all of those, I think.
And they like to nod and just
right.
say, yeah, I get what you're saying.
They're important. And no one wants to, you know, appear foolish. And so oftentimes, even when patients who have normal English proficiency, but they don't understand the medical terms that you're using, or they're confused because they're nervous, they'll nod and maybe hope that a family member who's there will explain it to them later. And that often can lead to, misinterpretation of medicines or things like that.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. It might sound like it's Wellness Wednesday, but you know that point in a conversation with a physician where they're trying to figure out why you're there. We're talking about how OSU Medical, this College of Medicine, is using virtual reality to help train physicians in that process. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Douglas Danforth. He researches and studies virtual patients in VR in his lab at the OSU College of Medicine. Now, this is something that another benefit of this VR and having software that does this is that students can take it with them. It doesn't have to be in a VR format for them to use it. They can just take it on the iPad or whatever they have.
That's correct. In fact, most of the time we deliver the virtual patients on an iPad. So the students just open up their iPad. They open up the virtual patient and they speak the questions.
Do they wear a headset?
They generally don't. They can if they want. It does result in some interesting conversations when they're trying to interview the patient at Starbucks or in front of the TV. The virtual patient hears all of the audio
chatter,
that's coming
yeah.
in, and sometimes they get confused when, you know, the student is ordering a latte and they're trying to understand what they're actually saying.
the students get immediate feedback from the program too. How does that differ from what you provide when you're giving feedback?
So with the standardized patients, they will give feedback in the practice sessions. But when we're doing assessments, there are so many stations, we don't have time to stop every assessment and give students feedback. With the virtual patients, the software records all of their questions, categorizes them, and when they're done, they get a report. Okay, I asked these questions in these categories, but I missed these questions here. And so they get to practice. And then they also get an expert's approach to the case. So they can compare their performance against a gold standard. and understand in different cases why it's important to ask a particular question for a patient that, for example, comes in with back pain. Why is it important to ask if the pain radiates down your leg or if it just stays in your back? The expert's approach to that explains the importance of those questions, and they can compare their performance against an expert.
How long did it take to develop this software?
We've been working on it for almost 10 years. We collaborate. I have colleagues in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering and Linguistics. They do a lot of the sophisticated natural language understanding software. And then there's a separate bit of software that we use that relies on patterns and rules, and I write that software. And actually, our system uses both. When a question comes in, both systems analyze it. And if they agree, we have high confidence that we understood the question and we provide the answer. If they disagree, then we have a third bit of software that chooses between the two based on which one is more likely to be correct. So even with all of that, and that's a pretty complicated system going on in the background, we still only get the answer right about 8 out of 10 times. Under ideal circumstances, we're above 90%. But if a student's in a noisy environment or talking to their roommate or asking questions in unusual ways, we're about at 80%.
How many versions of virtual patients do you have?
We have about a dozen or so what I would call typical virtual patients, just patients with different chief complaints, back pain, chest pain, abdominal pain. We have some specialized patients we're creating now. We're creating a virtual cancer patient to help doctors and nurses practice difficult conversations with patients who've just received a difficult cancer diagnosis. And we're also creating a patient with opioid use disorder. So physicians and healthcare providers can practice interviewing or interacting with a patient who abuses opioids and might be a candidate for medication-assisted treatment.
What about people who are just not communicative? They're difficult to talk to. They're not good at describing what's wrong.
I think any system that allows students to practice and get comfortable with that. So one of the advantages we see of the system is not ever to replace interacting with a real patient. That's the ideal. But if students can practice, get the questions in their mind, get the, you know, all of the things that they need to ask, so they're not thinking about that when they're talking to a patient. That comes naturally. Then they can focus more actually on the patient and eliciting information from the patient, responding with empathy to the patient's care and concerns.
The same grant, that Medicaid grant that you referred to, it also funded this training, will fund training for building empathy with dementia patients.
That's correct.
And how does that process compare and contrast with VR that covers English as a second language, for instance?
It's a little different. So we haven't used a lot of actual virtual reality yet. You can put the headset on and actually be in the room with a patient. But as I said, most of ours are done via the iPad. But the Dementia Project is done by the Advanced Computing Center for Art and Design. And they actually have you put the virtual reality headset on and you are experiencing what life would be like if the world was confusing to you. And so you actually get to experience what a dementia patient might experience, things that this cup of water here is clear to me, but a dementia patient might be confused about that. So the software allows you to experience what a dementia patient is actually experiencing, so you have a better sense of what the patient is going through, so you can help them a little bit better.
And what are the next steps? What's next in this universe?
So one of the applications that we're using, the dialogue technology, the virtual patient technology, is in a virtual reality simulation for mass casualty training. So we just got funded to create a virtual reality simulation of a mass casualty incident. We are creating initially a subway bombing scene, and we'll do an active shooter after that. But the first responders, paramedics, EMTs, medical students, will put the virtual reality headset on, and they will actually virtually be in the bombed-out subway platform. There will be victims all around, and they will have to, what we call, triage that scene. Identify who needs care most urgently, who can wait. They will go around to the victims. They will identify what life-saving procedures are needed and perform those. And as they're doing that, the system will grade them. How quickly are they doing it? Are they categorizing the injuries correctly? And the virtual patient technology will allow them to communicate with their victims. You know, can you hear me? Are you hurt? Can you move? We'll be using the technology to train first responders.
What's the cost-benefit analysis of this technology going forward?
The advances in the virtual reality technology now make it really inexpensive once you get a simulation trained to be able to deliver that to a lot of folks. So in the past, if you wanted to do a simulation like that, you would have to go to a clinical skills center that had a very expensive virtual reality system built in. Hmm. When we get our system built, we will simply take it to Worthington Fire Department. And all it requires is a virtual reality headset and a little bit of space. And all of the paramedics, the fire department folks, can go through and actually practice in their space. So it makes it a lot more accessible to a wider audience.
What kind of feedback do you get from the students, the medical students, about this and how they like it? Or that's got to be part of the equation.
It is. We get feedback from all of our students. In general, the students like the ability to practice. They especially like getting feedback on how they did. They get frustrated when the patient doesn't understand what they say, because, you know, we're guessing always, and we guess right about 80%. But I think the biggest frustration that they have is they ask a question that seems like a reasonable question, and for whatever reason, our software doesn't pick it up right, and they get frustrated because it's not answered.
Well, Douglas Danforth, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for asking me. Bye.
Douglas Danforth, he researches and studies virtual patients and VR in his lab at the OSU College of Medicine. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. Harry Potter Wizards Unite is now available in the U.S. and the United Kingdom. The game brings players into the world of Harry Potter, letting them play as a wizard or witch of their choice. Joining us now to talk Potter and more is Android Central contributing editor Russell Holly. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I just started rereading the Harry Potter series this week.
Cool.
Yeah. So are you loving this? Tell us about Wizards Unite.
Yeah. So this puts you kind of in the Harry Potter universe. Some massive calamity has happened. And there are these wizard things, events that are happening all over the world. And you are one of many different people who are tasked with kind of going around the world and finding these things to keep the normal non-magical people from finding them. So you kind of move quickly and get these things and make them disappear so that it doesn't, so the rest of the real world doesn't find out that magic is real.
Is this augmented reality like Pokemon Go?
This is very similar. It's made by the same company. So the idea is very similar. You look down, you've got a map. And as you walk around the map, you've got fortresses and greenhouses and inns that all kind of tie into the Harry Potter universe. And as you go through and play the game, you'll run into characters that are very familiar and creatures that are very familiar if you're a fan of the series. Creating an account includes, picking a house, but you're not, it's not like you're in school. It's not like you're in Hogwarts. So you're not fighting against other factions or other classrooms or anything like that. You don't have to worry about any Slytherin versus Gryffindor or anything like that. It's really just kind of a personal choice. And you get to work together with anybody as you go through and play stuff in the game together. So it's less team versus team stuff like you saw in Pokemon Go and more kind of everyone working together.
How true is the game to the books and films?
Well, it's kind of an interesting question. The way that they have designed the game, there are these things that pull you back to what they call the Legend of Hogwarts. So it's kind of a reminder of things that happen in Hogwarts, and that can be a little confusing because you will run into characters in the middle of this kind of this like magical remembrance. These are characters that are definitely dead already, as far as the books are concerned. Spoiler alert: some people died in the books. And so that can be a little confusing if you're not reading every single line in the game. But the game itself is supposed to take place at a time where Harry Potter is older. He's an adult now, and you see him in the game and you interact with him in the game. And so you still get to kind of get a feel of these characters. And it's been a while since I've read the books, but a lot of this is really kind of a nice tie-in to that universe.
I always thought the last movie was kind of corny in how they depicted them as adults. What's that like interacting with them as adults?
So, Harry is one of the characters that you get as kind of a text and voice. So you can hear Daniel Radcliffe's voice, and it just sounds like Daniel Radcliffe. It doesn't, sound like an artificial old man or anything, but it doesn't really give or take anything away from the experience, in my opinion, aside from, occasionally hearing his voice and being like, oh, hey, that's him.
You can connect with friends on the game. How does that work?
The same way it works in Pokemon Go, there's a friend code system where you can take your friend code and you can share it with others and they can put it in and you can be friends with them. Being friends makes it easier to share things with one another, and it also makes it faster to join in kind of group events together. So you can go to fortresses and actually participate in kind of large scale fights together. And doing that has some advantages.
Is this, or like Pokemon Go, so you're walking around town, am I going to see people in wizarding attire walking around with, their nose stuck in their smartphone?
That's the idea. I am disappointed in the people in my neighborhood, in that I have yet to see anyone in like fully dressed up in the wizarding gown to play the game. I know that there are definitely people walking around playing the game. In their defense, it is 90 degrees here. So maybe they are being a little more practical than I would have been had I decided to go out and play the game in the middle of the day.
I got to go dig up my kids' old Harry Potter glasses, and maybe that'll do the trick.
That's right.
There are things called traces, foundables, and co-foundables. What in the world are those?
Yeah, so this is all part of the game experience. As you're walking around, you'll see things pop up on the map. Some of these things are items that you can collect. Some of these things are things that need to be, kind of hidden away from normal people. You want to kind of hide the magic away. And some of these are creatures that you have to fight. All of them kind of fall under the name traces. So you're actually scouring the world looking for traces of magic. So you just kind of walk around, and the more you walk around, the more you will see these things pop up. As you get closer to things like inns and things like that on the map, you will see more of these items pop up. And the game, just like all of the other games made by this company, they encourage you to just continue walking around and exploring more of the world around you.
Players get to pick a profession. What did you pick?
I went with a professor because the professor's abilities are all about helping the rest of the team do stuff. So that way I could like sit back and give people health when they needed it and make the spells more accurate and stuff. And I didn't have to have anybody worry about how terrible I am at casting spells. Cause you have to like draw a shape on the screen in order to cast a spell. And I am real bad at it. So I put my skill in other places, but yeah, there are three skills. There's the professor skill, the professor, job. There's the combat focused job, which is the auror. And then there's the Magizoologist, which focuses on the different creatures that show up in the game and the advantages you get with interacting with them.
Do you have to pick a profession?
You, at level 6, it tells you that you should pick a profession. And you can actually switch back and forth between those professions pretty quickly. If you decide that there's something you would prefer to do after trying it for a little while, you'd rather have something else, then you can pretty easily switch. But yeah, at level 6, it says, you really want to pick a profession.
Okay, the books have stood the test of time. The movies have as well. What about the game?
I think the game is going to stick around for a while. This is something, it's definitely not going to be as explosively popular and kind of world dominating as Pokemon Go was. But honestly, like, nothing is as popular as Pokemon. So that's, and this also deliberately targets a slightly older audience. You know, it really targets someone that's right around my age for this kind of gameplay. And as much fun as it is, I just don't have as much time as my kids do to walk around and play this stuff. So, like, this, it's actually been kind of fascinating. My kids have read the Harry Potter books and have seen most, if not all, of the movies, but are just not as excited about this game as they are about the Pokemon Go game that they are and still play.
Huh, that's interesting. Do you play the Harry Potter game with them like you did Pokemon Go?
I certainly tried to, but then it ended up just being me. And then hilariously this weekend, me and my mom, because I grew up reading the books with her.
Right, right.
So like this weekend, like all of the grandkids got together and we just like they went and swam in the pool and my mom and I went and walked around the town and did stuff.
I'm thinking that might cool. be something to do with my kid, you know. We grew up, absolutely. You know, going to the midnight Harry Potter reveal parties and when the books would come out. And yeah. Raspberry pie, another dessert named computer. It's a Raspberry Pi 4. It's a new version. What's new about it? What's great about it?
Yeah. So this is something that started, a little over 10 years ago now. And the whole idea here is to have this self-contained computer, this box that did everything. You just added power to it, and it could be just this very simple computer that did one very specific thing well. And that usually is something, just setting a display on a monitor that's very simple. There are bars in my area that actually use them to display the websites that have, like, the full, like, drink menu. That it just, you know, shows up on the screen and it's this tiny, inexpensive computer that powers that whole experience. And so every couple of years we get a new version of it. And this is the fourth iteration of it, the Raspberry Pi 4. And the biggest reason to be excited about it is it allows for higher quality visuals and a much faster data connection, both wired and wireless, so that you can present more information using the same basic idea that you would. With some of the previous versions. So instead of, the last version, you know, I would only be able to stream video on it, say, that was like an HD screen. Now I would be able to stream something that was a 4K screen and you know, not have to worry about it, overpowering that machine.
I can't believe it's only $35.
That's been the big thing about this PC, this little computer for every version, is that it is the biggest feature to it really is that it's just very inexpensive. You can take one of these. It doesn't require a whole lot of power to make them work. It doesn't require a whole lot of, know-how to make them work. You can kind of plug these into just about anything, and they are, you know, very capable little machines that are very inexpensive. And that's what's been the most popular thing about them over the last couple of years, is that, you know, this allows so many different creative types who would otherwise have to kind of build a machine and figure out, you know, what purpose they want it to, could just pick one of these up for $30 or $35 and just have it work.
I mean, it's a big deal in the do-it-yourself community, right? And people, I mean, for $35, my gosh, I mean, that's a nice dinner out for one night. It's
right.
How can they do that? And meanwhile, back at the ranch, people are spending thousands of dollars on computers.
Well, I mean, there's a very big difference between a traditional desktop PC and one of these. Like the amount of computing power is very, very different. These are great for individual tasks. They are not great for being, you know, kind of your day-to-day computer for most people. But it is also worth pointing out that the Raspberry Pi is what powers the extremely educational friendly Kano computer that we've talked about a couple of times. Mm-hmm. That is the computer that's kind of inside of that system. And part of why that system is able to be as inexpensive as it is because these things are able to kind of get, you know, in bulk. And as for why they are able to be so inexpensive, mm-hmm. this is a company that was built around this single purpose. You know, so the parts that they're getting, they're able to negotiate very, very low cost deals. And these are boards that they're printing themselves. They started off only being able to make a couple hundred of these at the time, and now they have an actual design facility that they have built over the last couple of years. But it has always been a very small company putting together this idea that, you know, if you can make computers inexpensive enough, then you can introduce really anybody in the world to this kind of computing.
Besides the DIY community, who are they sending it to? Is this for, I mean, who wants them?
Well, I mean, this, a lot of people have started using, you know, we say the DIY community, not a small group when you think about people being able to use them for home video servers at home. And like I said, a lot of businesses have started using them to do things on you know, like the monitors that you see displayed on walls. A lot of times you go into hotels and you see kind of the hotel menu set up on a display. A lot of those end up being powered by Raspberry Pis.
Okay. That's it right there. The consumer technology company, is it Oppo or Oppo?
Oppo, yeah.
Yeah. They are saying that they have successfully hidden a camera under a display, creating a true full screen display. Why is this a big deal?
So this is actually something that's been a problem over the last couple of years. If you look back to, let's say, the iPhone of 2 years ago, you had a big fingerprint sensor on the bottom and you had a big thing on top for the camera, and there was all of this space on top where the display wasn't living. And so when the iPhone 10 came out, the big deal was all of the camera stuff was put up top in this really small area and the fingerprint sensor was removed. And so you had a whole lot of room, a whole lot more room on the display and not all the stuff on the top and bottom. So it was able to make the phone, instead of making the phone bigger, it made the screen bigger and kept the phone the same size. Over the last year, we've seen a couple of companies try to work on what are called in-display fingerprint sensors, where you actually, Samsung did this with the Galaxy S10, and there have been a couple other companies where the actual fingerprint sensor is actually underneath of the display. So you put your thumb on the screen, and the part that does the fingerprint sensing stuff actually wakes up and takes the fingerprint sensor, but you never actually see that sensor the same way that you used to see the circle on the iPhone. But you still have this camera up top. Cameras are kind of a hard thing to hide, and that's what Oppo is promising here, is actually take the camera and have it hide behind the display so that it looks like just a flat sheet of glass that's just all display, but there really is a front-facing camera hiding underneath of there.
The whole full-screen display thing has become a big thing. Why is that? What is it, just that you can't really explain it? People just like it, or what?
Yeah, I mean, it's just very pretty.
Yeah, okay. I keep thinking there's... I mean,
really,
I overthink things, I think.
Yeah, it really is. It's just become a visual trend. It doesn't offer any kind of technical advantage. There's an argument there for when cameras used to kind of pop up and move around, that fewer moving parts was better. But we haven't really had that for a while now. So, like, it really is just a highly visual thing to have everything, you know, kind of tucked away behind the display. But it's also... this is something that's kind of been programmed into our brains for a really long time by science fiction. You know, a lot of sci-fi television shows, when there's video chat happening between people, there's not like a camera visible. These are people that are staring at a screen and they're able to kind of see one another as though they are looking into each other's eyes. And we know that sitting in the audience as that's just a trick of cinematography. It's not, you know, that's not how this technology is actually designed, but it gives the people designing this technology the ability to say, well, what if it actually works like that? And so that's kind of the direction that things have been trending towards. It would be incredibly cool if you were looking at, you know, when you video chat with someone right now, you're never really looking into their eyes because you're never staring into the camera.
It is
you're
a weird thing, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So if the camera is actually in the display, then you actually get much closer to feeling like you're actually looking at that person's face.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I get that. Thanks for illuminating that for me, Russell Holly. As always, I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
That's Russell Holly, Android Central contributing editor, our regular on Tech Tuesday. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.